The Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra will perform in Miller Auditorium this Friday at 8 o'clock. That means tomorrow night at 8 p.m. And I'm really thrilled to have the maestro of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, Raymond Harvey, here in the studio to talk about this magnificent work, Mahler's Symphony No. 6. Welcome, Raymond.
Nice to be here.
I'm so glad that you could take the time. We were just talking during the news that you had just finished conducting an opera in Houston.
Yes.
And next day, on the plane, back to Kalamazoo.
Yes, it's a kind of a wild schedule for me these days. I'm at the University of Houston as music director of the opera department there. And we just performed three performances of an American composer's opera called The Inspector. The composer's John Musto. Wonderful piece, only written 6 years ago. A really hilarious comedy, but very tricky and a lot of work. I was having thoughts of Mahler in my head during it. So I'm happy to be back here and working on this wonderful Mahler Sixth Symphony.
I remember you championing a young composer, Peter Boyer.
Oh, yes.
In years past here in Kalamazoo,
yes,
at the KSO.
Yeah, and he's doing great.
Bringing new music to our concert life here in Kalamazoo, too. This is not exactly new, but it is unfamiliar. I think there's a chance to hear Mahler is one that everyone should take.
Yes, and there are people who know the more popular Mahler symphonies, Symphony No. 1 or No. 5, and the big Resurrection Symphony No. 2 with chorus. But Mahler's symphonies are all very different. There's no one formula for his symphonies. And the Sixth Symphony, which is called the Tragic Symphony, is not done as much as the others. It's a very dark work, and as most Mahler symphonies, it takes huge forces on stage to do this piece. I counted we have 101 musicians on the stage for this.
Up from a core of about 65, 70?
Our roster is 85.
Oh, okay.
This piece calls for especially an expanded woodwind and brass section and percussion. In most of our symphonic works, we will play with three of each type of woodwind, you know, three flutes, three oboes, etc. This calls for five of each woodwind type. It also calls for eight French horns, six trumpets, four trombones and tuba, and a battery of percussion.
I'm curious where the additional musicians come from.
A lot of our musicians do come from our local Greater Kalamazoo area, because we have fine players and some good players that can augment our forces in times like this. But we also bring players from the East Lansing area, from the South Bend area, some from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And for the musicians, Mahler 6 doesn't come around that often. So the opportunity to play this big work is really exciting for them.
My other question about these expanded parts is, was Mahler just looking for volume, or does he somehow split the sections and create lines and extra parts?
What he's doing, and it's a real marvelous craftsmanship, he's looking for more colors. It would be like a painter who needs to have different hues and different tints and be able to combine them. So Mahler's not just blasting us with one texture, but he'll combine three oboes with three muted trumpets, or he'll add a piccolo to a high clarinet. And so he's mixing these sounds, and it makes it really exciting because you're not quite sure how he came up with this new sound palette. It's really quite interesting. There's a lot of loud playing, of course, and he certainly takes advantage of having these forces. But there's some gorgeous, subtle, quiet moments with this ability to mix the colors so effectively.
I remember discussing Mahler's use of nature sounds, mm-hmm. His pastoral, maybe, qualities that he's very good at painting. I don't know if this symphony, he's appreciating nature or not.
He has a couple of interesting moments. The most striking one is he calls for, in the percussion section, now don't laugh, cowbells. It's probably the only symphony that has cowbells in it. But he asks for cowbells, real cowbells, to be gently rung during three of the four movements of this piece. And the rationale behind that, and I'm not sure how he came up with this, is that the sound of a herd of cows gently walking across a field and their cowbells ringing is supposed to be the last sound you would hear from Earth if you were high up above the Earth in the heavens. And so in some of the more celestial parts of this symphony, all of a sudden, there are the cowbells.
Does Gustav Meyer include a story of any kind or a narrative to go along with this symphony?
There's no story with the symphony, and even the title Tragic Symphony, they're not sure whether he named it that or someone else named it that and he accepted the title. It's a symphony that's about fate and destiny. It has a very driving aspect to it. It's sort of a relentless approach. A lot of the music is like a march, whether it's a march to battle or a march through adversity. It's broken up by a beautiful andante movement, but the other three movements are fierce. It's unusual in many respects. It seems to be a very personal statement from Mahler. It's traditional compared to his other symphonies in that it's in four movements. It has a scherzo. It has a slow movement. It has movements that are in the typical what we call sonata allegro form, where there's a theme and then it's developed and then it comes back. So it has those aspects, but on such a large canvas. Very, very unique.
Tickets are available at KalamazooSymphony.com or by calling the box office. The website again, KalamazooSymphony.com. It's at 8 o'clock tomorrow night in Miller Auditorium as part of the Symphonic Series. And I'm with Raymond Harvey, the conductor of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra. We have a recording that we'll sample from this hour. Boulez conducting the Cleveland Orchestra.
Yeah, Vienna.
Vienna. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, thank you for the correction. I want to talk about I understand there's some unusual choices that you as a conductor have to make.
Yes.
With this before you even bring the music to the musicians.
Right. One of the things about this symphony, there's been controversy since he wrote the symphony in 1905 about the order of the movements of the symphony. There are four movements. The beginning movement is an allegro. The final movement is an allegro, a finale. But the two middle movements, one is a scherzo and one's an andante. When Mahler first wrote the symphony, the middle movements were in the order scherzo and then andante. After his first performance conducting the symphony, he then did a performance and reversed the order of the middle movements. So he did the andante and then the scherzo. It confused people. It confused publishers. Some works are published one way. Other publishers published it the other way. Mahler's wife, his widow, after his death, Alma Mahler, was asked by a publisher which order should they be in, and she definitely said, no, he meant it, the scherzo and then the andante. Conductors have gone crazy trying to figure out which way to do it. And I made a decision based on my experience as an audience member listening to this work. It's a very long work. It's about 77 minutes long. And for me, sitting listening to it, when the first movement is finished and the next movement is the Andante, which is beautiful and romantic and emotionally climactic. If you do that Andante as the second movement, then you have a third movement scherzo and a very long finale. So that moment of repose in the Andante comes too soon in your evening. You don't need that then. You need it later. So I'm doing two unusual things, somewhat unusual. I will do the first movement and then the scherzo, because I think the Andante needs to wait. But I'm also decided that this is too good a piece to worry about the length of the work and to sort of feel, oh my goodness, this is going on for so long. So I'm putting an intermission in the program. We'll do the opening movement, we'll do the scherzo, we'll take an intermission. Then we'll do the Andante and the finale. I want people to be able to absorb this and to be able to get a break in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And heaven knows the musicians will love that break too.
Definitely. Yeah, ability to absorb and process a little bit of the first half mm-hmm. of the symphony and then have fresh ears for the second half, beginning with the lovely Andante,
yes.
taking us to the finale, which I yes. hope will have all the drama returning.
Oh, the finale has everything in it. The use of percussion instruments is also rather unique in this, besides the traditional, you know, timpani and bass drum and cymbals and triangle. Mahler calls for two timpani players because he's got six drums up there. And so you have two players who are playing, sometimes together, sometimes separately. And kind of a cute thing here for us at the KSO, Mark Guthrie is our principal timpanist. Well, we had to bring in a second timpanist. The second timpanist we brought in is Mark's son, Christopher Guthrie.
Oh, wonderful.
Who's a marvelous percussionist. So, you know, it's kind of cute to have father and son there on the timpani. But the other percussion instruments, there's the big gong, the tam-tam. There's xylophone, which apparently is the first time Mahler put xylophone in a symphony that he wrote. But they're the cowbells that we mentioned. But there's also the call for something unusual in the finale. Mahler wanted a big, loud, startling sound. And so he wrote a part for sledgehammer. and he specifies that the sledgehammer sound, it's a big sledgehammer that you have to hit onto a wooden box. He wants to make sure that the sound is not metallic sounding, but it should be a wooden thud that just explodes, resonates around the stage. We actually had one of our players make a gigantic sledgehammer and make a wooden box for it with some resonating ability so that the player can lift up the sledgehammer and kaboom. I'll talk more about that later, but it's quite dramatic.
I would like to take a short break so we can hear the opening of this so-called tragic symphony. I am curious about why he used did he use the word tragic, and was he thinking about his own life?
There's something to be said for that too, because he was a very superstitious man.
Okay, well, we'll hear a little of the music and be back with Maestro Raymond Harvey of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra. Again, the concert is tomorrow night at 8:00 in Miller Auditorium. Will there be a pre-concert
yes.
discussion?
Yes, I'll do that.
7:00 in Miller Auditorium. That's music of Gustav Mahler, and I'm here in the studio with Maestro Raymond Harvey, and I don't want to lose any time with the maestro talking about this impressive piece by Gustav Mahler, one of the late Romantic composers who expanded the symphony to its limits.
Mm-hmm, pretty much. one has to remember that Mahler, besides being a great composer, was also a marvelous conductor. So he worked with orchestras all the time. He knew what their capabilities were. It's amazing that he wrote as much music as he did because he had a full-time job as the head of the Vienna State Opera. And he had to do most of his composing in the summer, during his summer vacations. This symphony, he wrote it over two summers. He wrote it in the summer of 1904 and the summer of 1905, I believe. And he was in it's interesting that he writes such a tragic, dark symphony when he was in one of the happiest times of his life. He had just married Alma in 1902, and around these summers when he was composing this, they had their second daughter. So he had these two wonderful little girls to play with in his vacation time while he was writing this kind of brutal symphony. Mahler also was a very superstitious man, that came into play later in this symphony. When we talk about the last movement, I'll explain some of that. But the scherzo movement, which would be nice to hear the beginning of, it's almost as though it's a variation on the first movement, that relenting march, that relentless march that we had in the first movement, is now carried over in a certain way to the scherzo. Mm. The timpani is again very prominent, there are moments even in the strings where he writes something for them and he explains in their music it should be like being whipped, being lashed. It's very dramatic, it stomps its way through. I think it'd be nice to hear the start of that scherzo movement.
And that's part of the scherzo,
which
will be heard.
It's really
rather
charming. You know, the beginning of the scherzo was that stomping rhythm in the timpani and the horns going crazy. But then the part that you just heard before we faded out is much more gentle, much more dance-like. And Mahler actually writes this to be played in the old-fashioned style. So it harkens back to a different age, almost a Baroque kind of thing. Very charming, very unexpected.
Social dancing being just a part of everyday life.
Oh, certainly.
In that whole century.
And a part of the history of folk music and music itself.
Yeah. And Mahler was certainly one to use from real life sights and sounds and mm-hmm. dance styles mm-hmm. in his music, which is often why, when people talk about his symphonies, they say it seems to contain the whole of life and existence mm-hmm. and so much.
Right. And Mahler, of course, wrote for voices in many of his symphonies, which added text, which added wonderful poetry. But he can make that poetry even without the voices.
This is Mahler's sixth symphony. Mm-hmm. How many would he go on to write? And when
he wrote nine, but he started a tenth, and there have been other people who have tried to finish Mahler's 10th symphony because he did not finish it before his death. But the nine symphonies are still very much in the repertoire. There are more popular ones. There are more happy ones. But they're all very interesting, indeed.
I do like one of the first things you said about the symphony was it has a driving quality. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is very modern and dramatic.
Yes, oh, very sounding. Much so. And, you know, and again, when you realize that this is a man who spent his life in the theater conducting opera, he was a theatrical person. So he certainly could find that drama in his symphonic works.
He died young, yes?
Yes, relatively young. Again, there's something about that in the finale of this symphony that I will talk about in a moment.
Well, yes, hold on. Hold on to that.
Can't give it all away.
We also don't want to skip over the Andante.
The Andante, yes, which is really lovely. We have to remember that Mahler wrote a lot of beautiful songs, so he knew how to make the orchestra sing, and you can hear it right at the start of this beautiful E-flat major Andante.
I'm speaking with Raymond Harvey, who will conduct the Sixth Symphony of Mahler. It's the only piece on the program tomorrow night, starting at 8 o'clock in Miller Auditorium. Join Maestro Harvey at 7 p.m. for a prelude talk on the piece, so you can learn a little more. And all that information and more is at the website, kalamazoosymphony.com. Here's the Andante from the Symphony No. 6. We're leaving the Andante so that we can finish this hour by touching on the final movement of the Mahler Sixth Symphony. Maestro Harvey, has this work been performed in recent history of the KSO?
According to my records of what the KSO has performed, I don't see that the KSO has ever done the Mahler Sixth Symphony. So that's kind of shocking, you know.
How can that be?
In 96 years, we've not done this symphony. So this is quite a treat. if there are people here in the community that have been waiting for it, here's your chance.
Let's recap some of the things we've touched on this hour in case people are tuning in a little late. First of all, the symphony will add dozens of players to the stage for this performance.
Yes. We're glad that the Miller Auditorium stage is large enough, but in addition to our normal complement of about 85 players, this one takes us up to 101 players. Expanded winds and brass especially, five flutes, five oboes, five clarinets, five bassoons. There will be nine French horns on stage, six trumpets, four trombones plus tuba, two harps and celeste, and a battery of percussion, and of course, a large, large string section.
Another thing to mention, it's the only work on the program, and therefore, there will be an intermission.
Right, which is not traditional, I must admit, and I'm sorry for the purists out there. But the work is almost 80 minutes long. And 80 minutes is a long time to sit and listen to a piece, no matter how marvelous it is, especially in our day and age of everything being quick and fast. And I would rather the audience truly absorb this work and enjoy it than think about, my goodness, this is really long. And so after the first two movements, we'll take an intermission and then do the last two movements. And I think the experience will be enhanced by that break.
Are there any things that we haven't yet mentioned?
Well, I did want to mention, you brought up about Mahler's life, and I mentioned that he was a rather superstitious man. In the finale of this symphony, he writes for a sledgehammer, and he actually has three places during this very long finale where the orchestra builds up to a climax, and all of a sudden at the climax, this gigantic sledgehammer has to be pounded onto a wooden box, a very thuddy wooden sound. They have said that these hammer blows were the blows of fate, of one's own tragic destiny. There were three such blows in this last movement. And in retrospect, they tended to foreshadow three awful events in Mahler's life. The first blow to his own personal life was the death of one of his young children in when she was just a toddler. The second blow was the loss of his job, his wonderful job as conductor of the Vienna State Opera. And the third blow was his diagnosis of a fatal heart disease. In the symphony, after these things happened to him, after the death of his child, after his loss of his opera job, he thought that this third blow of fate was going to be too much, that it might actually spell his death. And so in subsequent performances, he took out the third hammer stroke. So instead of three now, there are only two.
He did everything he could to keep the final hammer of fate from falling.
Exactly.
That is superstitious.
Startling. Very startling.
Well, what did you decide to do? All three or just two?
You know, I thought, now people that know me and how crazy I am, I thought about doing, you know, the first two hammer blows. And then I thought about having the percussionist raise the hammer for the third one, but not do it. But I was afraid that might be a little too comic. So we will just do the two hammer blows. We don't want to kill Mahler again.
There is something pretty magical about how you mentioned earlier that the hammer itself has been built for this performance.
Yes.
And the box on which it falls.
Yes. Mark Guthrie, our principal timpanist, spent a few months designing and building a big wooden hammer with a wooden resonating box so that we could get the right sound. It's quite something, I must admit.
The insider line says that it's quite a shock in rehearsal.
Oh, yes,
too.
Yes. It has a shockwave effect through the stage and hopefully through the audience as well.
This is going to be a special one-of-a-kind, really,
oh, yes,
performance.
You know, to my knowledge, there's no other symphony that has a sledgehammer in it.
The concert is tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, and Maestro Harvey will give a pre-concert prelude at 7 p.m., and you can find out all that and more at the Kalamazoo Symphony website, kalamazoosymphony.com. Raymond Harvey, thank you so much for talking about Mahler with me today.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you tomorrow night. Here's the fourth movement, and we'll start a little ways in just to make sure that we hear those hammer blows.